Last Sunday, I spoke about a lasting image from my time in ministry. It was from a congregation that served just prior to this one, one that has stayed with me over the years. I have another one for today that goes back considerably further than one I cited last week and one I know I've spoken to in one way or another during my time here. This one is of Martin Luther King standing with other religious leaders in Arlington National Cemetery on a very cold 1968 February afternoon, calling for a silent prayer for peace at the height of the Vietnam War. I was only one person in a crowd of several thousand ministers, lay leaders, and seminarians. I could see Dr. King very clearly and then listen to him deliver a speech at a church in Washington, D.C. later that afternoon. I was a 22-year-old divinity school student at the time. 42 years have passed since then, but the image is as clear as ever. And even after all these years, I consider that instance one of the proudest moments of my life, as I, along with all those others gathered there, stood with one of the greatest Americans of the 20th century, one whose birthday we now observe as a federal holiday. It wasn't even on my mind then, but if somebody had asked me that time, if I thought I'd live to see the day when an African American would be elected president of the United States, I'm really not sure what I would have said. It's just that the possibility seems so remote. There's a horribly bloody war on. It was increasingly making little sense to hardly anyone. And the country was reeling with racial turmoil. Whether or not we'd ever had a black African-American president, as I recall, it wasn't even getting a whole lot of conversation, not a whole lot of discussion. But on that same cold 1968 February day, there was out there this six-year-old first-grade African-American kid who would, 40 years later, turn that seemingly remote possibility into a reality. He would take his oath of office almost 1 year ago today to the day, as President of the United States, not all that far from where we all stood that day with Reverend Dr. King. And so in Reverend Martin Luther King and in our President Barack Obama, we have two, putting it mildly, remarkable Americans. They are of the same race, but separated by more than a generation. Each of them occupies a highly significant and yet quite different role in the larger ongoing narrative that is that of the United States of America. Theirs are the roles, respectively, of prophet and president. And in this case, it was the prophet who made the president possible, as Mr. Obama himself has gratefully and humbly acknowledged on more than one occasion. And yet the mantles that were and are placed upon them bespeak differing roles for them. And it is the nature and the meaning of those differences that I'd like to devote a little bit of attention to this morning as we observe both the 81st birthday of Martin Luther King and the end of the first year of Mr. Obama's presidency. To first note one more similarity, however, each of these gentlemen was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace with an interval of some 45 years in between. And each one delivered a very marvelously crafted acceptance speech, some of what we heard earlier in the service. I'll be citing some other portions of it a little later. And as I gathered my thoughts for this morning, I went back and got them up on the internet there and printed them off and read both of the speeches. The most noticeable difference in the two could be seen right off the bat. Dr. King's speech required that two sheets of paper be run through my printer in order for me to get the whole text. Mr. Obama's took 10. Like I said, we're talking about the difference between a prophet and a politician here. But the difference really has little to do with the length or brevity of a speech. For the content of each of those speeches really does get at this difference that I'm going to be speaking to. The prophet, to start with that then, is the one who stands outside the corridors of power and calls the powers that be to greater and higher levels of what our Unitarian Universalist, Second Unitarian Universalist principle calls justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And some of the earliest models for this kind of prophet, and when I say prophet, I'm not talking about a seer or somebody with a crystal ball. It's a different definition here. Some of these early models are found in Hebrew scripture, known to Christians as the Old Testament. The prophet was the one who confronted the king and or others in positions of power and authority on behalf of the poor, the oppressed, or any of those who were being disenfranchised in any way. One off-cited example of this stance is that of the Hebrew prophet Amos, who stands in the public square, condemns King Uzziah for his oppression of the poor, and speaking for Yahweh, Amos tells the king that Yahweh God will not accept his, the king's, ritual sacrifices, will not listen to his ceremonial rites until justice is truly done. And he concludes, Amos concludes his admonition by saying, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." That would be Amos, the 5th verse, 24th chapter, for those of you who are following along in your Bible study. Just indulge me a little ribbon now and then. All right. So when Martin Luther King stood at the Lincoln Memorial and delivered what has come to be called his I Have a Dream speech, he saw himself as standing in that tradition, the tradition of the Hebrew prophets in which Jesus, as a prophet himself, also stood. The soundbite clips of that speech, which I know are going to get played, or are getting played, will be played over and over this weekend, the soundbite clips of that speech, most of them anyway, tend to show only the final cadences of the speech, which are indeed among the most moving and inspiring words, I think, that are found in American public discourse. In fact, I would place them in the same category as the concluding paragraph to Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. But showing just the last few minutes of Dr. King's best-known speech or sermon, for that's really what it was, it's also, in a way, a kind of a way of prettying it up. For that last stanza, as it were, is preceded by some very harsh commentary about the state of race relations and racism in America, as well as the plight of the poor in the early 1960s, late 50s, early 60s. They are words by Dr. King that would make Amos proud. In fact, the very words of the prophet Amos to which I just referred were ones that Dr. King himself invoked at an earlier part of his speech. So when it comes to his or her power, then, the prophet has to rely upon moral authority and upon the power of moral persuasion. Prophets, by and large, do not have their hands on the gears of actual political or civic power. They rely on the power of the Spirit, if you will, to in turn push those whose hands are on the gears. And such prophetic power should never, ever be underestimated. We already heard words by Mahatma Gandhi. He and his followers, using some very creative, nonviolent tactics, played a major role in ending the British rule in India. Power of nonviolence, power of moral suasion, power of moral authority put a pretty good dent in the British Empire at one time. In addition to the Hebrew prophets, Gandhi also, as many of you know, was a major mentor and influence in guiding Dr. King as he directed and chose many of the tactics, the nonviolent tactics that he used in the American Civil Rights Movement. And when he accepted his Nobel Prize last month, President Obama acknowledged that he was, quote, someone who stands here as a direct consequence to Dr. King's life work. He then continued, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there is nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive, in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King, close quote. And yet even with such heartfelt and with such humbly appreciative acknowledgments, the President's Nobel acceptance speech had a markedly different tone and a different slant to it than the one delivered by Dr. King 45 years earlier in 1964. For standing in the same hall as did President Obama to receive the same award, Martin Luther King said, sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace
and thereby transformed this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict, a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. Take those words by Dr. King, place them alongside those of President Obama in his acceptance speech when he said this: "We must begin by acknowledging a hard truth. We will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetime. There will be times when nations acting individually or in concert will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified. Evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement would not have stopped Hitler's armies. Negotiations cannot convince Al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history, of the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason." Close quote, President Obama. Well, I read these two statements, made nearly half century apart, by two very remarkable and outstanding Americans. And I wonder if I'm copping out of myself when I find both of them, in my mind, each in their own way, to be true. Neither man was being naive. Neither of them was being stupid. But while they each may have delivered their speeches in the same physical spot, they were also each standing on and speaking from different ground. For the president did and does, indeed, have his hands on the gears of political and military power. Having his hands on those gears, in fact, it's right there in his job description. There is no such clause in the job description of the prophet. Now, to be sure, a caveat here. Any elected official from the president on down needs at times, when the times call for it, to exercise some real inspirational, if not rhetorical, leadership. The president and any other elected official at times does need to speak from what Theodore Roosevelt called the bully pulpit. I would say the difference is the prophet speaks truth to power. The president or other elected officials speak truth from power. And so I'm talking about a difference in roles, with each role having its own kind of necessity. The role of the prophet is to hold up a vision, a hope, even a promise of who and what humanity may yet become. And without that role being taken on, from Amos to Dr. King, without human beings like Amos and Dr. King being ready to live and die in fulfilling that role, we human beings would quite likely still be crawling around in our caves. Someone always has to be calling us to be more than who we are. Someone has to call us to who we may yet be. We still have not reached the day when, in any complete and final fashion, justice rolls down like waters, righteousness like a mighty stream, but that hardly makes Amos wrong in calling for such a day. In fact, it makes him right. Dr. King's dream remains only partially fulfilled, but that does not make him wrong for proclaiming it. In fact, it makes him right. The path Dr. King took in pursuing his prophetic stance and actions was that of the African-American church, the one in which he was born and raised, in which his father was also a minister. While his journey took Dr. King to Boston University, where he earned his PhD, the church remained his ground for action. The organization through which he conducted his civil rights efforts, after all, was called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. As his civil rights efforts grew, Dr. King, of course, had to reach beyond the church as he found himself a titular head of a national movement and a phenomenon, but the African-American church was still the place where he kept his feet planted throughout his life. Barack Obama's path was more that of academia and then politics. His community organizing work in Chicago gave him a deep appreciation which he had not really previously had for the role of the church in the African American community. It impressed him to the point of fact that he embraced Christianity and joined a congregation. But the church was not and is not his arena in the way that it was for Dr. King. Mr. Obama chose to operate on the inside of those corridors of power and get his hands on the gears. And in so doing, he made his way clear to the top. I happen to believe that Mr. Obama's commitment to social justice and peace is as strong as that of Martin Luther King's. But the path he chose and the ground from which he operates is not and cannot be that of the prophet who stands outside the halls of power in order to speak truth to power. I kind of wonder sometimes if some of the disappointment or the deflation that some of our president's supporters may be feeling after his first year in office may well come from the fact that they were projecting their needs and desires for a prophet onto a man who was, just after all, running for president. Mr. Obama used some humor as he addressed this very matter back during the campaign. You may recall when he quipped a couple of times, contrary to what some may think, I was not born in a manger. I think that was his dry humored way of saying that I'm more a politician than I am a prophet. Now please understand, I am not using the phrase more politician than prophet in any kind of a pejorative way here. For if the prophet is the one who holds up the vision of a just society, while also pointing out how far we still are from it, it is the politician, and I mean that in the best sense of the term now, the one who truly seeks to serve the public, the polis, is the politician who actually has to mesh and sometimes grind the gears to get us even incrementally closer to the prophetic vision. Along this line, President Obama has cited Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr as his favorite philosopher and theologian. Let's take a little trip on that direction for just a minute. Niebuhr, during the early to mid-20th century, was a professor for many years at New York City's Union Theological Seminary, which is one of the premier mainline liberal Protestant seminaries in America. One of the ironies of Dr. Niebuhr's life is that for all of the scholarly books he wrote on religion and theology and politics, he's best known as the author of the Serenity Prayer that is said at practically every 12-step meeting that gets held. Niebuhr had no ties to the recovery movement itself. Those folks just discovered his prayer and decided they liked it. It was one that he more or less had dashed off to wrap up a sermon he delivered at a seminary chapel service and kind of got out there and took on a life of its own. In academic and political circles, though, Niebuhr is best known as the exponent of what he called Christian realism. As the term suggests, it means that the broad-based moral and ethical principles of Christianity, which are really universal, common to many faiths, can only and ever be partially realized as they are worked out amidst the many imperfections of an imperfect world run by imperfect human beings. I know it's a gross oversimplification to boil a man's theology down to a single statement, but that's in a nutshell is it. That's about as much as I have time for. I'm not going to do a lecture on Niebuhrian theology here. But in writing on the subject of this Christian realism, you could call it moral realism as well, Niebuhr once noted, democracy is finding proximate solutions to insoluble problems. Now, I know that line is not exactly as memorable, or as doesn't come to mind, or doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well as, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Those are good words by themselves. But try this other one on for size. Democracy is finding proximate solutions to insoluble problems. Now note that Niebuhr does not say impossible problems. Insoluble in this sentence means problems for which a full, complete, and perfect solution most likely never be found. This does not mean that one gives up on those problems or challenges, though. You pursue instead the best proximate solution you can. So if the role of the prophet is to speak truth to power, the right and proper role of those who hold power is to pursue those proximate solutions to the greatest extent possible dealing with the realities of the times and the circumstances in which they're pursued. And when you put this difference out there, this difference in roles, there's always going to be a certain tension then between the prophet and the person who, even with the best of intentions and motivations, has his or her hands on the gears. And so in looking over this past year, I would say we have a president who draws his moral and ethical inspiration from Dr. King, while looking more to Dr. Niebuhr when it comes to how he actually conducts his business and does his job. And speaking for myself, I feel that's the way it needs to be. That's probably the only way it really can be. I'm going to cite just a couple of examples of what I'm getting at here before I close for today. Like many of you, I would imagine, I was often frustrated and disappointed at the way in which the health care reform legislation worked its way through Congress to the point where it now is. And when I take a deep breath and read a little deeper, I also conclude that what's there now, with all its many flaws and imperfections, represents a proximate solution to an insoluble problem. And the key word for me here is proximate. Proximate means there's always more that can be done further along the road to make the problem at least a little less soluble, or insoluble, that is, than it is right now. In fact, my anger over the past several months when it comes to this matter is not with those who pursue proximate solutions, however much I may have agreed or not agreed with any one of them. Instead, it was with those whose only objective has been to frustrate, subvert, and undermine the achievement of any kind of solution, however proximate, to one of our most crucial domestic problems. I'll leave it at that. The other area where I feel quite conflicted in the same general area, same general scene, is the conflict in Afghanistan and how our president has chosen to deal with it at this point. I have no quarrel with him when he says, as he did in Oslo, "I face the world as it is. Evil does exist in the world. To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history and the imperfections of man and the limits of reason." Dr. Niebuhr's sentiments are all over that statement. And when I think of the words that Laurie shared with us earlier from Mahatma Gandhi, I'm not sure he would disagree with that either. And one thing I am clearly not is a military tactician. This does not prevent me, however, from asking the question of how wise, and more to the point, how moral it is to significantly increase the danger to both American troops and Afghan civilians by way of increased troop presence to get at a specifically designated target that so far has proven itself to be immune to the use of traditional military force in combating it. And that's about as far as I can go with that one right now. But the question that I raise here is an ongoing one. It is one which, in one way or another, and with a good measure of tragedy, whatever the outcome, will be answered. To bring this closer to home now, part of our calling here is to be a prophetic community. Part of our calling is to act on what my now retired colleague in the UU ministry, the Reverend Richard Gilbert, calls the prophetic imperative. We are called to hold up a vision of what a world blessed by justice, equity, and compassion in human relations would truly look like. We are called to be inhabitants of a planet in which the respect for the interdependent web of life, of which we are all a part, becomes truly a global reality. And in so doing, in acting on this kind of prophetic imperative, we must respect and work in whatever ways we can with those who have chosen to work in the midst of the many human imperfections, the many human failings that befall us. Even when the gears of justice and peace move far more slowly than we wish, the point is to make sure that they keep moving at all, however slowly at times, so that what Theodore Parker called the moral arc of the universe will continue to bend, however slowly, towards justice. And this now in closing. Part of the prophetic message is to say, we're not there yet. This need not be a statement of despair, but rather one of hope. Hope that we human beings can continue to reach beyond ourselves and even beyond the time on earth that is granted each one of us. And know that by faith, there still is, there still will be, more joy, more hope, more love, more peace, somewhere, sometime, if we will continue to use our small but vital efforts to make it so. Martin Luther King's time on earth tragically ended before he even reached the age of 40. But I believe he died knowing that there would be more love, more peace, and more hope somewhere. For the night before he lost his life, he did say to an assembled audience, as he invoked the story and the image of Moses, that he had been to the mountaintop and had seen the promised land. We're still not there yet, but thanks to his prophetic life and ministry, we are that much closer. So with all this in mind, let's sing together, "There Is More Love Somewhere." It's number 95.